You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
In the Januaries of 1928 and 1929, respectively, two residents of Memphis, Tennessee, Sterling T. Dunn and Van Skelton, were found murdered in their cars in a wooded area outside the city limits. The area was known to locals under the ominous name of Ghost Grove, although that was an informal name. At the time, the murders were connected in the minds of the residents to a number of other murders and assaults that had taken place over the years. This is episode 113, The Story of the Ghost Grove Killings. Machen once wrote that strange things are lost and forgotten in obscure corners of the newspaper. Welcome to Forgotten Darkness, a podcast that will aim to prove that that statement is true. Before I get into today's story, I want to say that it's good to be back doing another episode. It's been more than a little while, but I also need to let you know of a minor little update to a past episode. This one's to episode 108, which was about the Mourner murders in New York State. Quick rundown in case you hadn't heard the episode. In 1911, Mary Mourner and three of her children, Blanche, Edith, and Arthur, were murdered and their bodies stashed in the barn. Another son, Jesse, lived in a house nearby, and it was he who found the bodies. It was generally assumed by the police that a hired hand named Edward Donato had been guilty, but Donato was never found. The locals, meanwhile, felt that Jesse was the guilty party. Well, I suppose I really need to check my Instagram messages a bit more often, because a few months ago I had received one from the person who now lives at Jesse Mourner's old farm. According to the message he had sent me, apparently it's still a quite common assumption that Jesse did, at the very least, have something to do with the murders. The Mourners were a decently well-to-do family, and after their deaths, the surviving son inherited the land. He sold his farm and moved into the house in which his parents and siblings had lived. The house also has a reputation as being haunted. Now, on to today's story. Around 7:30 on the evening of January 6, 1928, in Memphis, Tennessee, a woman drove onto Kyle Street. After parking the car near the intersection with Foster Avenue, she got out, told a young boy to call an ambulance for the man in the car, and then fled into the darkness. The boy did as he was told, and soon an ambulance arrived for the still unknown man and took him to Baptist Memorial Hospital on Madison Avenue. The doctors determined that the man had been shot in the neck. Back on the suburban street where the car had been parked, police arrived on scene to investigate. They soon determined that the car belonged to Sterling T. Dunn, an employee of the Goodwin Crockery Company. Dunn lived at 55 South Cox Street and left a widow, Lottie, and three children, Eugene, Walter, and Doris. Discovering a blood-stained handkerchief and a .32 caliber pistol inside the car, the police went to the hospital to speak to Mr. Dunn. Detective Lieutenant Lee Quianthi and Detective Sergeant Lewis Crosby spoke with Dunn, who said that as he was driving slowly along South Parkway near Center Street, now Roselle Street, a black man had jumped onto the running board of his car and ordered him to put up his hands. Dunn reached for his own gun, but before he could pick it up, the thief fired his and shot him. The two officers at the hospital called for Detective Sergeant William Lemmer back at Dunn's car, but by the time he arrived, the man who had been shot was nearing unconsciousness and was unable to speak. Apparently, his wound was more severe than it appeared. Dunn's wife, however, contradicted his story, saying that he didn't have a pistol. Also maybe contradictory was the call made reporting the shooting. Captain Fallon Thompson, the policeman who had received the call, was told that a woman had shot a man. Apparently, the boy believed that the woman who had been driving Dunn's car had killed him. After receiving Dunn's statement, police doubted his story. In a bizarre turn of events, around 9 o'clock that night, about the same time Dunn was being questioned at the hospital, a call came in to a Memphis garage asking the manager to look up license number 88-663, which was the license plate on Dunn's car. But though the caller, a woman, said her name was Hall, she hung up before the manager, M.C. Horn, could ask any further questions. The funeral of Sterling T. Dunn was held on the afternoon of the next day at the Collierville Methodist Church, and shortly thereafter, he was buried in the Magnolia Cemetery, also in Collierville. With someone, either the thief or the mystery woman, now a murderer, police said the investigation was pretty much at a standstill while they waited for the arrest and questioning of Hazel. On January 8th, police said they were seeking not only Hazel, but two unknown men. They had determined who Hazel was, they said, but they just couldn't track her down. Inquiries at Dunn's place of work, the Goodwin Crockery Company, turned up that on the afternoon of January 6th, a few hours prior to Dunn's murder, a letter written in pencil had arrived. It came in a typewritten envelope and said, "Won't you see me for a few minutes between 12:30 and 15 of 1, Saturday at the same place? Important if not rainy." Police thought both the typeface and purple ribbon with which it was typed were uncommon ones, but there are no further articles about whether they ever tracked the typewriter down or whether it proved to be at all relevant to the case. A bit over a year later, at about 2:15 on the afternoon of January 22, 1929, a switch train was passing along the Illinois Central Railroad trestle over Castalia Avenue. C.C. McCaskill, a railroad fireman and engineer, was driving the engine and noticed a man lying on the ground next to a parked car. Thinking it might be just a sleeping drunk, McCaskill thought nothing more of it as he passed by on his way to work. Shortly afterward, McCaskill's crew passed that way a second time, but noticed the car was missing, although the apparent drunk was still lying in the same spot. Stopping his engine, he investigated and discovered that the man was not drunk, but dead. As soon as he was able, McCaskill phoned the police and told them of the dead man, but was told that since the wooded area was outside city limits, it was properly the purview of the Shelby County Sheriff. Sheriff's deputies McCarley Palmer and R.L. Sorensi were dispatched. The deputies found a man lying on his back on the ground, a hat placed over his face. He looked to be in his 40s, rather tall, in a dark blue suit and with a fireman's badge bearing the number 140 pinned to his clothing. At first they believed him to be Clarence P. Cox, as insurance papers bearing that name were found in the man's pockets. The sheriff's office decided to make the investigation a joint one with Memphis police, since the dead man had apparently been a city employee. Captain W. Frank Glisson, in charge of the Memphis Homicide Squad, and Sergeant William Lemmer, who had questioned the dying Sterling T. Dunn at the hospital, took the case. They found that the fireman's badge identified the dead man as not Clarence P. Cox, as the deputies had thought, but as Van Skelton, a co-worker of Cox's at Station 14. The insurance papers were in his possession, said Cox, because Skelton was helping him to obtain a better insurance premium. Captain Glisson and Sergeant Lemmer combed the area for more witnesses, only two of which provided anything of interest. J.S. Owen, a switchman on the Frisco line, said that at around 2:45 in the afternoon he saw a Ford drive out of the woods. A man dressed in a black suit and hat washed his hands in a ditch and then drove off. Was the man he saw the murderer, or simply McCaskill just before he called police? The other they found was a black woman named Maud Mitchell, who said that she had seen a car pass by her house with a woman and a man inside, the woman driving. The man seemed to meet the description of Van Skelton. A short time later, she said, she heard what seemed to be a gunshot, followed shortly by the car again emerging from the woods, this time with the woman alone. Meanwhile, the deputies made the death notification to Van's wife Margaret. Already mother to five children, Margaret was pregnant with a sixth. Questioned as to his movements that day, she said that Van had left their house at about 1:30 that afternoon. He was working night shift at the station, which was confirmed by Captain O.V. Ayers, commander of the fire station. His brother Herbert was also at the house and drove him downtown. Herbert confirmed this. Mrs. Skelton had an alibi, so it wasn't her that had killed her husband, as Palmer and Cerenzi had at first thought. When asked if there was any reason that Van would have been out where his body was found, she said he was quite an inveterate gambler and frequented a place somewhere on Pigeon Roost Road. As this was not very far from where the body was found, had he been killed at the gambling hall and his body dumped? Glisson and Lemmer were beginning to piece the story together. Herbert had confirmed that Mrs. Skelton hadn't left the house that day. Therefore, so long as Maud Mitchell's testimony checked out, the wife wasn't the woman in the car with Van Skelton. And whoever she was, she had apparently dumped the body from the car before she left. They needed to speak to this woman, as a witness, if not a suspect. How exactly it happened is somewhat unclear. Most sources say that a cryptic phone call was made to the police a few hours later, telling them to speak to the wife of a Jethro Maddox, with others saying that the police had already determined her identity and were the ones to call on her. Either way, the woman in question was indeed Mrs. Maddox. Glisson and Lemmer drove to her home at 1229 South Orland Street to pick her up for questioning. Jethro Maddox was an employee of the Illinois Central Railroad, Myrtle Maddox told the detectives. For about a year now, she had been seeing Van Skelton whenever her husband was out of the city. Currently, Jethro was in Kentucky for work. He was a suspect in the murder for a brief time until his whereabouts that afternoon were determined for certain. Mrs. Maddox told the detectives that she and Skelton had driven the Maddox car south along Castalia Street into the forested area called Ghost Grove, parking at a point just below the Illinois Central Railroad overpass. On the trip, she noticed a young black man walking along the road beside the car. The car had been parked only a short while when the young man they had passed jumped onto the running board of the car and thrust a pistol through the car's window, holding it to Van Skelton's head. He demanded that Skelton turn over his money, which, probably wisely, he intended to do. However, as he reached for his wallet, his coat pulled back to reveal his fireman's badge. The robber, seeing the badge, apparently thought Skelton was a policeman and fired twice. Then he ran off. Mrs. Maddox, however, had noticed one thing that could narrow down any potential suspect. The robber had only three fingers on the right hand. After he had run away, Mrs. Maddox sat in the car for a few moments to make sure the robber had gone, and then pushed Skelton's body out of the car. Driving to her home on South Orland Street, she cleaned the blood out of her car the best she could, and then burned the rag she had used. While the search for the robber continued, the newspapers reported the next month that some of the police were connecting the murder of Van Skelton to those of two railroad men. G.M. Gillihan was found lying near the corner of 3rd Street and Calhoun Avenue, beaten and with a knife wound behind his left ear on February 22nd. He had apparently been robbed. He died the next day. A railroad fireman named J.W. McCaslin disappeared on February 8th, and after months of denials by the Memphis police that a body found in the Mississippi River near the Harahan Bridge was the missing man, and complaints by McCaslin's relatives, he was found alive at Fort Benning, Georgia. But the three-fingered robber proved to be more difficult to track down than the police and Mrs. Maddox had anticipated. On March 10, 1928, just 2 months after the Dunn murder, 18-year-old George McGonigal was held up and robbed while driving with a 17-year-old girl named May Ollathorne just a short distance north of where Van Skelton had been killed. Taken was $1,185, a ring, and a wristwatch. McGonigal, though, had given police an extremely detailed description of the stolen watch. Nonetheless, things were quiet until August 3, 1929, nearly 8 months after the murder of Van Skelton. On that day, police received an anonymous letter naming a black man named Sam Jones as the killer. They swiftly apprehended Jones and brought Mrs. Maddox into the station for an identification. Mrs. Maddox said that though Jones had a mustache when arrested and did not during her rendezvous with Skelton, she was certain it was the same man. Jones's hand was injured in the same way as the shooter's, and in fact he was nicknamed Stubbs on account of this. However, the police were forced to release Sam Jones since while the letter contained a large amount of incriminating information about him, it was penned anonymously and thus none of it could be confirmed. but by a stroke of luck almost worthy of something from a movie, on October 9th, police received another tip, this one from a pawn shop owner. A watch matching the description and the serial numbers of the one taken from George McGonagall a year and a half before was pawned by an Edward Bishop Jones. When Detectives A.O. Clark and W.T. Pilkington apprehended Edward, he turned out to be none other than the man arrested 2 months before under the name Sam Jones. But after he was identified by George McGonagall as the man who had robbed him, Jones confessed to the robbery and said that another black man named Kahoma Reed had aided him, along with another named Effie Glynn. Glynn was already serving time in Toledo, Ohio for attempted murder there. Edward Jones denied having anything to do with the murder of Van Skelton, however. He did, however, say that a man named John Duckett Smith had shot and killed Sterling T. Dunn in an attempted robbery. Jones also attempted to lay blame for the Skelton killing on Smith, but Smith laid the blame on Jones. Once told this, Jones changed tack and admitted that he had been acting alone in the killing of Van Skelton. After a rather brief trial, since all confessed their respective parts, Edward Bishop Jones was convicted on two charges of murder, and John Duckett Smith on one. Both were given life sentences in prison. Kahoma Reed was found innocent of murder, although convicted on a robbery charge in the case of George McGonagall. I was unable to find whatever became of Effie Glynn, although I assume he was left in the Toledo jail, despite an effort made to extradite him to Tennessee for trial. Lottie Dunn never remarried after her husband was killed. She died in 1976. Likewise, Margaret Skelton also never remarried, at some point moving to Phoenix, Arizona and dying in 1979. However, Myrtle Maddox remained married to Jethro until his death in 1967. Myrtle herself died in 1981. And that's the end of this episode. As always, a list of sources consulted for this episode can be found in the show description, and photos associated with this week's story will be on my Instagram at Forgotten Darkness. If you have a question, a comment, or if you know a lesser-known story that you'd like to see covered, leave a comment on my podcast page, post it to the Facebook page at Forgotten Darkness Podcast, or send it to my email at ForgottenDarknessPodcast@gmail.com. I'm also on Twitter. I hate the new name, so it will remain Twitter for me. At Forgotten Darkness Podcast, and you can DM me ideas there. I also have a Google map available with the locations of various episodes. There's links to all these pages in the show description as well. So, until next time, this is Andrew, signing off.
This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.